Dr. Nelson. Dr. Nelson, how do you regard the Civil War and the moral issue?
Well, that's so broad.
It's broad, isn't it?
It's very broad.
Let me then, let me read you a quotation.
Yes.
As a starter,
yes.
Some way in. This is from Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
The war began in the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union. The North was fighting to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get beyond the limits of the Constitution, and the North fighting for the old guarantees. Both sides despising the Negro, both insulting him.
What was the second part of your... You said, what about the Civil War?
Well, how do you... Just refer to this... Just take that as a starting point. What do you... How would you respond to that quotation? Frederick Douglass.
It had three parts.
Yes,
there.
It does. Let me... Dr. Nelson, why was the Lincoln... monument chosen as the spot for the March on Washington to reach its climax?
Of all the figures in American history, Lincoln for the Negro represents that single individual who did most to free him, not simply from slavery, but in the larger way. That one fact, the fact of the Emancipation Proclamation, if there were no other fact, would draw the Negro to the Lincoln Memorial. I think beyond that, Lincoln's total life and as a human being appeals to not only the Negro group, but to any group that is struggling against vast odds. In India, I found that Lincoln is regarded only second in the estimation of thoughtful Indians, only second to their own greatest heroes. I have seen in certain halls two pictures, one of Gandhi, one of Lincoln. I come constantly across literature, both literature of substance and daily periodicals speaking about Lincoln, and in the highest terms.
Now, would those Indians know that Lincoln was a racist, a thoroughgoing racist? For instance, this quote, this is a well-known quote from Lincoln after the Emancipation Proclamation. No, this was before, this is Douglass, but it's the same sort of thing he said after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes.
I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social or political equality of the white and black races. And he goes on and develops that. He said, this is a very commonplace thing, these quotes from Lincoln.
Yes.
But this has some bearing on the question. Now, some problem of history and the relativism of history must enter at this point.
As you know, very recently, certain forces in the South published in newspapers.
I just long after I had raised this question for my purposes, which is a little different.
Yes.
But I'll say that Lincoln's a hero of mine, by the way. So
yes.
I quite understand.
I think this is a proper question, and I was expecting it.
Well, naturally, you have.
Yes. But I think the Washington Post, for example, gave a proper answer.
Did they have something?
To
I
that.
Didn't see it, yes.
And it is something I have thought about often in my lifetime in connection with all our heroes, including Lincoln. And that is that they have their weaknesses. They are men who have grown. They live in certain contexts. And particularly when you're living in a political context, you're likely at times even to feel at one time what you don't feel at another time, not to speak of saying at one time what you wouldn't dare say 20 years later or 10 years later. Every thoughtful man will permit a man to err, even to the extent that we feel Lincoln erred in that view.
Is there a question of a difference in 100 years? What was, as one historian, an eminent one, said to me about Lincoln, why in 61 it was impossible to find a man, a white man, on the American continent, probably in Europe, who was not a racist?
That needs to be considered.
That this was an assumption that was so readily made then, that the world has changed with 100 years of scientific investigation.
Yes.
And 100 years of other things.
Yes. 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 So you have two spans of life in which to make a judgment on what he said. His own span of life, his own growth, and you have a century that he spoke 100 years ago, and we are living 100 years later.
With the benefit of science and other researches in between.
Quite. It's just like our view toward the Civil War now and then. It could well be that if we all lived then, we would not even have given a thought to the possibility of avoiding the Civil War. Today, I would suppose you would find many, many people who have discovered in their own lifetime and in their own thinking ways by which the Civil War might have been avoided. We must give Lincoln, I think, credit from that standpoint.
The world, I'm getting to this point now. Do you feel that the world has actually changed its moral climate, at least America has, on this question, say, in 100 years? The moral climate has changed.
Yes.
There's a discernible progress.
Unquestionably.
In the whole temple of society.
Yes. Wherever slavery exists in any form today, society as a whole, the American society, is profoundly unhappy with regard to it. 100 years ago, or a little more, it was in our own bosom. Today, we excoriate any nation, however primitive, that has in its context slavery. So that is a difference that 100 years have made.
This point is an important point in a way, because there are people, both Negro and white, who refuse to see or don't see any change in the moral climate. Now, not long ago, I was talking with a very, very able lawyer in New Orleans. On tape, this way.
Yes.
And he burst out, he said, "It's against my desires, but I must say that I am feeling that the white man is beyond redemption. That I'm about to become a black Muslim," he said. "I'm even reading the literature now. I feel that there's no hope." This question I'm asking, moral climate, he said, no, he burst out with this. This man's a thoughtful man, an educated man, a very able lawyer.
A Negro.
He burst out with this. So this is not always the answer one gets.
No.
But there is a change in moral climate.
There is a change, but even in that change, you're going to get persons who hold to a view that some held 100 years ago.
Sure.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Let me ask a question about the Reconstruction. This, again, is looking back and playing with history.
Yes.
Or have you ever played this game of trying to set up what would have been the reasonable Reconstruction policy in the South? Because we're into Reconstruction right now, of a sort.
No, I haven't, Mr. Warren. And I would be afraid, I think, to venture along that line. You must do it in the context of all the facts of that time.
Sure.
And I wouldn't want to attempt now to try to recall what all the facts were and then to develop a theory as to how best Reconstruction. I might have some overall philosophy, but that isn't what you're asking for.
Well, I would ask for the overall philosophy, too, if we could turn it to that, if you choose.
Well, my overall philosophy would call for the what we call the nonviolent way of life. It means forgiveness of wrong. It means love of another in spite of hate for you. It means a searching for every possible method of accommodation that is moral, not immoral, that would win and not defeat, that would draw to you and not drive away.
Myrdal laid down a program that he thought would have worked.
Yes.
It runs something like this. Federal remuneration for freeing of slaves after the war, Reconstruction.
Yes.
Pay the slaveholders. 2, expropriation of plantation lands, but with their full federal payment. Both for slaves and for land, southern land. Distribution of land to any who would work it, Negro or white, on a long-range mortgage basis, not a gift, but minimum payments.
Yes.
Supervision of the freedmen and the property for a period, for education purposes. Universal taxation of the country to pay these costs. Encouragement of Negroes in westward expansion, moving as many as possible out of the South on government lands and to the North. That seemed to make practical sense. Even if it wasn't possible.
Well, I would be very glad, were I given the time, to begin to develop a position with regard to
yes.
the period on this basis. I would say this would offer promise. Now, before I could judge each of them, I would want to see, well, what do other economists think? What do other historians think? Of that time, what did they think? What do they think now? And then arrive at a judgment. My judgment would have to be one not of an expert, as Murdoch is an expert, but on the basis of an array of positions of experts, and from the standpoint of a generalist in this field, as a mine would have to be a kind of philosophical look at all the alternatives posed by those who are expert in particular. I think this gives a good point of departure.
At least Myrdal is attacking the notion of Reconstruction as punitive. He's trying to make a Reconstruction society for peace rather than as Reconstruction as a punitive measure, that he wants to pay and all, make it work.
I would agree with that assumption. I would agree with that assumption that Reconstruction should not have been punitive. And I think that's one of the reasons why the loss of Lincoln was so fearful.
Yes.
That I think he would have approached the future, that is, after his emancipation, on the basis of reconciliation. What would have happened, one doesn't know.
He might have been shot by somebody else there on the other side.
It could have been.
A radical Republican could have shot him then.
It could have been.
Fanatic.
It could have been. That's always the possible fate of one who plays that role. But I think we love him in a sense. We believe in him still in a sense because we believe he would have played that role rather than this other role. But I speak here as a layman in a sense and without all of the possibilities before me.
But it's the laymen who lead into action in these matters.
Yes,
it's
but
not
it,
the historians.
Yes, but it must be a layman who gives not only general thought, but must look at problems of this kind with a certain specificity.
Yes.
I think, express himself too offhandishly.
One more question on this general line before we break for our lunch. James Baldwin says, this is a very close paraphrase, the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern majority, but takes action in a moral vacuum. It fills a moral vacuum. Do you have any feeling about that notion?
I would tend to agree. I think that is a promising evaluation. I think that is a promising evaluation. I would say that the great majority of the Southern people want to be a good people, but they are fettered. And the mob takes advantage of the fact that the people, the masses of the people, the good people, are fettered.
Some Negroes and some whites say that they actually are conniving by silence, so that they are morally culpable in the same way as the mob.
To that degree, yes. Whenever we connive by silence, we sin, to use an easy word. We are wrong. And yet, all of us do that to some degree.
You can't yell all the time.
No. It seems to me, one of the great values of the nonviolent movement in the South is that it tends to evoke into speech and into action those who are silent under other circumstances.
I think that's true to a degree. I've seen some of it happen.
Yes.
People who've said, "Doc, this hurts me."
Yes. I think that's one of the great promises of this nonviolent attitude under any circumstance of stress and while you're trying to win a cause. It reaches, let us say, the good people, in quotation marks, who are the majority of the people in the world. I mean good deep down, who give promise of rising to a higher level in social crisis. You reach them. The other position, the position of violence, drives them into the camp of the people who are less good. Now,
shall we knock off there for the moment?
Yes. Fix it up.
You can fix it up,
say,
sure.
As
you'll,
the Indians say.
You'll see it again.
And,
but we don't want to have it formalized. Exactly. We want to have some sense of conversation in these
two. Yes, I understand. I understand, yes.
Dr. Nelson, could you say something about the growth of your awareness of the relation of the Negro to American life from boyhood?
Yes.
How did the question present itself to you?
Yes. I was born in Paris, Kentucky, in 1895. My parents moved when I was 10 months old to Paducah, Kentucky, in the western part of Kentucky, where I went to school through high school. Among the things I remember about Paducah is the fact that on the courthouse grounds, by which I passed frequently, across from which I worked in a barber shop shining shoes, a Negro at one time had been lynched. I can remember a kin of mine, my mother's father-in-law, Billy Kersands, who at that time was a great minstrel leader and who came to Paducah each year with his troop. He was a blackface minstrel actor. I walked down the street at the head of his parade, as was the custom then, on the day of the night when he gave his performance. I can also remember going to hear the minstrels, but of course, always going to the peanut gallery. I cannot remember that at that time I was deeply offended by having to go to the gallery. That was the way of life in Paducah, and I can recall no conversations of that period of my life into which entered the whole problem of segregation in theaters and elsewhere. My father was a college graduate, a man with a Master of Arts degree, and a graduate from the College of Medicine of Howard University. He was a doctor. My mother taught school in Louisville, Kentucky. And therefore, I had an advantage over most of my schoolmates in that my parents were educated people. We were ardent church members, going to church three or four times on Sunday, and my life was profoundly affected by this church relationship. When as a young man I entered the army, lived in France, thousands of miles away from the influence of my parents, I felt the influence of the minister, of the deacons, of the church. And would also feel a sense of hesitancy about the doing of any act which might offend them. And I count that church influence as one of the great influences next to that of my home in my life. While in Paducah and before graduating from high school, I worked in a printing shop where a weekly newspaper was published, where I set type, and where I wrote articles, even as I recall it, an editorial occasionally. I was valedictorian of my high school class, and I spoke on the subject, a worldview. Leaving Paducah, I came to Howard University, where my father had studied. I served in World War I. I graduated from Howard University in 1920. Studied a year in Union Theological Seminary, and upon the death of my mother, I was distraught to the point that I felt the need of my professors. I went to Paris to study, to continue my study of theology, and there I studied in the Protestant Theological Seminary and in the University of Paris. From Paris, I went to Berlin, where I studied theology for a semester, and from Berlin to the University of Marburg to study particularly with Dr. Rudolf Otto, as well as with other Protestant theologians in the University of Marburg. After these 2 years abroad, I returned to the United States, finished my theological training at Yale University, and was graduated in 1924. While abroad, I did some writing, and I'm interested to discover that the subject was usually around such themes as a worldview, the international point of view, articles which were published in The Crisis or in The Messenger, a magazine published at that time by A. Philip Randolph and the Mr. Owen, his collaborator. My thesis then was that the Negro, in the solution of his problem, must see his problem in a world context, that he himself must not become so overburdened by his immediate woes that he remains unacquainted with the world outside, not only the American world, but the total world. I can remember speaking of the slave who lived in two contexts, the plantation and heaven in the skies. But we must find a world beyond the plantation on which one's feet are placed, and the life hereafter, and we must find it in the widest possible world of human relationships. That view remains with me until now. After finishing Yale University, I received an appointment at Howard University. But 2 consecutive years thereafter, I spent a semester each in the University of Marburg pursuing my studies in philosophy and religion. After 9 years of service to Howard University as teacher and administrative assistant to the president, I was called to Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina as president, where I served for 5 years, subsequently to Dillard University in New Orleans, where I served as president for 4 years. In those 9 years, I was to come into an intimate acquaintanceship with life in the Middle South and life in the Deep South as that life affected the Negro. At Shaw University, it was necessary for me to travel widely across the state, visiting the parents of the students of Shaw University, speaking in high schools, trying to interest students to enroll in Shaw University, and learning about the life of the people on the farm in the small towns. In Dillard University in New Orleans, I came to learn a very great deal about the life of the Negro, especially in the city of New Orleans. There, in very particular, I was profoundly affected by the inhibitions from which Negroes suffered. I can remember a trustee of Dillard University who was a teacher in the public schools, a Negro, but who would never be seen riding in a taxi with a white man for fear of losing his position as teacher, who would never think of having a meal with the trustees of Dillard University, some southern, some northern, fearing that this teacher might be dismissed from his position in the public schools. Segregation was complete, But I lived for 4 years in that city without attending a segregated theater, attending a theater only once, and that was attended only by Negroes. Never attending a theater or any other entertainment on a segregated basis, that is, where the audiences were segregated by race. Fortunately, I was unable to travel in my own car and therefore never subjected to segregation in transportation. I was deeply moved, however, by the fact that not only were the Negroes of New Orleans so accustomed to segregation that they moved freely in matters of entertainment and in matters of transportation under segregated auspices, and moreover, that Negroes coming from the North, where they had enjoyed freedom from segregation in many matters, subscribed to it in New Orleans. I have often said and often written, and sometimes written, that what is necessary is that a Negro, when he must be segregated, should sit in the segregated situation as if he were sitting on pins, that he should never be comfortable under those circumstances, that his inner self should always be in rebellion against that which was forced upon him. At least, if this he must do, he could avoid ever yielding his spirit to this way of life. I returned to Howard University in 1940, where I have served since then as Dean of the School of Religion, as Dean of the University, and as Vice President of the University. In the course of that period, during one sabbatical leave in 1946-47, I spent a year, or nearly a year, in India under the auspices of the American Friends Service Committee. During this period, I traveled over most of India. I lived at times with Mr. Gandhi when he was under the greatest possible stress, and was able to not to see him act under these circumstances and to talk with him by the hour in several instances in the midst of these circumstances. During this period, I met a considerable number of the then leaders of India, a number of whom, including Mr. Nehru and others, are still alive. I returned to India in 1950 under the auspices of the World Student Service Fund, and remained for 3 months visiting colleges and universities. I returned to India a third time in 1958-59 as a Fulbright research scholar attached to Delhi University, where I delivered an occasional lecture. My purpose then was to do research on the question of the continuing influence of Mahatma Gandhi upon life in India. I traveled over most of India and spoke with men and women in every level of Indian life. During my years as Dean of the School of Religion of Howard University, I founded, along with the other members of the faculty of the School of Religion, a magazine, a journal, called the Journal of Religious Life. The purpose of that journal was to relate religion to life. That journal continues to this day. During the years in the School of Religion, I also brought into being an institute of religion composed of well-trained Negroes in the field of religion, who I felt should have the opportunity once a year of sitting together seriously, discussing the problems of the relationship of religion to life, and eventually of publishing the fruits of their thinking. After a few years, this institute published a book published by Harper and Brothers, under the title of The Christian Way in Race Relations. This book went into a second printing, and for that year was included among the 10 best books in the field of religion. From 1940 until now, I have been profoundly interested in the nonviolent way of life.
You've been associated with Dr. King in discussing and formulating these principles, have you not?
Yes. Not, I would say, in a profound way, but through occasional conversations, through the interchange of thoughts, as I have listened to him and as I have read what he has written, as he has listened to me, as I have addressed groups where he was present, and as I assume he has read some of my writings. As I was saying, from 1940 on, I have been active, from the standpoint of thought at least, in the nonviolent movement, having participated in the March on Washington and helped to formulate the nonviolent principles which became a part of that movement.
Are you referring now to the original March on Washington movement?
The original March on Washington movement.
In 1941, is that right?
In 1941.
Yes.
Yes. I marched with them, and I wrote for them, and I can remember in Chicago praying for them.
Do you see any difference between the principles of that movement, as I have read in the formulation of Ava Pandolf, and the formulations that exist now around the movement, those of yourself and those of Dr. King and Dr. Farmer, Mr. Farmer?
They are basically the same. This was a period in the early 1940s when Mr. Farmer proposed that there be a national movement in this country built around the nonviolent principles of Mahatma Gandhi.
This proposal came from Mr. Farmer, you said?
He made a proposal.
He made the proposal.
He made a proposal at that time. This, I think, was unrelated to the March on Washington movement. But he made a proposal which was submitted to the Fellowship of Reconciliation for consideration and was adopted by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. This, I would call the first major document of our century proposing a movement for the rights of American Negroes on a nationwide basis based upon the nonviolent principles of the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings and practices of Mahatma Gandhi. Since my 1946-47 experience in India, I have been a serious student of nonviolence, writing and speaking as time from my administrative duties has permitted. My commitment to this way of life has deepened. At no point have I questioned its validity in principle.
Do I understand that the findings of Dr. Fishman and others who have studied the effects of nonviolence in the Negro movement now on the psychology of participants gives a naturalistic argument for what you approach through ethical and religious grounds, on ethical and religious grounds?
I do.
This, you have a naturalistic support in terms of his investigations.
That is my impression. And I have been very happy in my association with Dr. Fishman and his colleagues, because even though we approach this subject from different disciplines and different personal histories, we seem in very general accord.
Then Dr. Fishman, as one psychologist, would not agree with Dr. Kenneth Clark, as another psychologist, on this matter of nonviolence.
That is my impression.
That's an interesting fact, isn't it?
Yes. I would want to be very sure that there is this contrast,
sure.
But that is my present impression. Well, that is the story.
This is not getting so far afield as it may seem at first glance. I have in my hand here a clipping from the Morning Times, March 2nd, New York Times. The heading is Minister to Defy Fannie Hill Ban. Have you seen this?
No.
The Reverend William Glenisk will give out books, Fannie Hill, at the time of Bible reading at the Spencer Memorial Presbyterian Church in Brooklyn. Perhaps you'd like to glance at the whole thing before I ask you my question about religion and life. What do you make of that news story as regards religion and life? I didn't bring this for the purpose. I happened to take it for someone else, but I'll offer it to you since you've mentioned religion and life.
Yes. The reason I hesitate is that the whole question of religion and life is so broad, it is touched only peripherally by this article here.
Very peripherally, at least.
Yes. My definition of religion is that it, in its simplest terms, is the commitment of an individual to what he regards as supreme in the universe, the supreme person, the supreme power, supreme principle. A commitment not simply of the mind and of the spirit, but of the life. All else, for me, that men call religion is peripheral to this commitment.
This would lead to actions of social order, of course. I say of course, because I gather that from many things you have said.
Yes. The man's life can be judged as religious, not ought to be judged as religious, not on the basis of the scripture he reads, the creed he professes, prayers he prays, but on the basis of its consistency with his commitment to what he regards as that which is highest, greatest in the universe.
Does the giving out of Fannie Hill at the time of the Bible reading in Brooklyn seem to be an appropriate act in line with that definition of religion?
On the whole, this act seems to me to be a part of acting. Of an individual with respect to the literature he reads or commends to his child is a religious act if the judgment in that matter is made in the light of the individual's total commitment to an ideal. presumably any agency of religion, such as the church, has made this total commitment. And therefore, it is within its province to teach in relation to the specific affairs of life what it believes to be a commitment consistent with that total commitment. If society is agitated around a matter of morals, such as reading or non-reading salacious literature, it is appropriate for the leader of a church to address himself to that question, and to address himself to it in the light of the church's commitment, total commitment, to an ideal and as it relates to this specific problem.
Do you think that the selection of Fanny Hill for distribution at the Bible reading of a Sunday morning is an appropriate act or a tribute to this, or a trivial act, or worse?
If I were the minister of a church, I think I would not approach the matter in that way. Each leader has the right to introduce a subject of this kind in the manner in which he feels will be most effective in relation to the members of that group. He knows them far better than I can know them. It is very difficult for him to dictate to me how I shall present a matter of moral judgment to my constituency, and so it is difficult for me to judge how he should present such a matter to his constituency. The truth of the matter can only be determined by the effects of his particular act.
Change the subject again, or do you see any danger in the, or possible danger in the effect on the some of the young, the people who have now devoted themselves fully to the matter of civil rights? What happens to them, say, 5 years from now, 7 years from now? Is there a danger of certain psychological and intellectual casualties in this process?
I think there's always a danger to participants in a commitment wholeheartedly to any movement in which great principles are involved, and in which a kind of total commitment is required, in which the values are profound, the emotional drains are deep. I think there's always a danger.
I was thinking of some sort of parallelism between the possible fate of some of these young people and the fate of certain young people of the 30s who were deeply involved and deeply committed to matters of social justice of another approach. What's happened to many of them, yes, in my own experience, sometimes a very nausea and a withdrawal from all social action. We know the pattern of these dangers.
Yes.
I was wondering if here there's less than there was in that period. There's something more sustaining.
It seems to me that one of the saving elements in the nonviolent movement is that it's built around a moral core, or as some would call it, a spiritual core. This does not mean that every participant subscribes to that core, but it's there, and it's very difficult to avoid the feeling that it doesn't have some effect upon the participants.
But there was no such core in the general, in the various movements for social justice in the 30s to carry them, to carry participants over into another period and save them from the disillusionment that followed for many, for most, as a matter of fact.
That is a marked difference between many of our social protest movements of the past and this. Many of our movements had as their aim simply the achievement of an immediate goal by devious means. The best means are the means calculated to achieve that goal in the swiftest and most complete manner possible. The nonviolent movement wishes to achieve certain goals swiftly, if possible, and as completely as possible, but in a specific manner, a manner consistent with what the leaders feel are principles of the profoundest moral and spiritual character.
Tell me something about this split, or splits, among leadership in the civil rights movement. How serious do you think these rifts are as of the moment, as of this moment?
As I read the situation, the differences appear at this moment to be less grave than they have been in the past. It seems to me that there is an increasing cohesion in understanding and in action by these groups. It is perfectly easy to see how they would differ, just as individuals differ.
Have you followed the New York situation in the last week or two? The school situation, the school boycott, and the bus proposal?
I have read in the New York Times something of the trend and of the differences, and I'm not surprised that there are these differences. I think I haven't followed them in detail, and I'm in no position to pass any judgment whatsoever on who is right or who is wrong. But people differ in temperaments. They differ in their sense of what is most effective. Their differences on the questions of timing, that does not mean that the difference is profound. It is usually a difference of tactic. And I think, given time and a little less publicity and somewhat less public discussion of them, they can quickly be made the basis of such discussion as will bring the parties to mutual understanding.
There's two an outsider like myself reading the paper. There seems to be a deep and fundamental rift on this boycott question. Now, how deep, how nearly fundamental, I don't know, between the party driving for a total boycott and a total busing system, as opposed to people the core than the ACP view, which are sort of different and more studious look at the situation, presumably. I don't propose to judge between them, yes.
I can quite conceive how that difference would develop. As I haven't read each day the details, I wouldn't be prepared to pass any judgment on that immediate situation.
Shall we just stop here?
Yes.
I know you're